Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 454, titled The War President in Action. This is being recorded on April 4th of the year 2004. Before we begin, remember that there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record 454 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of this program. I would recommend that people use those descriptions because there is not only a detailed and more perhaps measuredly absorbable presentation of the material, but often there's material that I didn't have time to get in the original broadcast. Again, that's in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. At the beginning of each description, there's a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. And there are other For the Record shows available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. There is also a search engine now on the Spitfire website, and as soon as we upgrade the capacity for the website, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile will be available for download once again. We're adding some bandwidth to the Spitfire website. Now, this broadcast is something of an archive show. It's a review of material from past For the Record broadcasts dealing with Bush's handling of the war on terror. Bush has been billing himself in the famous Meet the Press episode with Tim Russert as the war president. Well, we're going to review the history of the war president in action. This past week, it emerged that among the many areas of obfuscation and obstruction that the Bush administration has engaged in vis-a-vis the September 11th investigative panel, something the Bush administration didn't even want to have formed to begin with, is the fact that the Bush administration has failed to release a vast trove of documents from the Clinton era to this administration. Article about that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Saturday, April 3rd of 2004. This is a New York Times story by Philip Sheenan, headlined, 9/11 Panel to Get Clinton Papers, subtitled, White House Won't Include Copies in Deal. The White House has agreed to allow the independent commission investigating the September 11th attacks to review thousands of Clinton administration national security documents that the White House acknowledged this week that it had withheld from the panel, the commission said Friday. But even as the White House struggled to convince the panel that it was not withholding valuable information, administration officials refused to make a commitment to allow it to have copies of the Clinton-era documents. And they suggested that similar, highly classified Bush White House documents might have also been withheld from the panel, skipping down. The final decision on whether the documents could be handed over to the commission was left to the Bush White House, which decided to block transfer of three-quarters of the nearly 11,000 pages of material, according to former Clinton aides who said they were concerned that so many of the documents had been withheld from the panel. Quote, "This is very disturbing," said Richard Benveniste, the former Watergate special prosecutor, who was a Democratic member of the commission. The White House said on Thursday that it had decided to withhold the Clinton documents from the other panel because they duplicated other documents, were not relevant to the commission's requests, or involved national security and were, quote, highly sensitive, unquote. Since all of the commissioners and most of the staff have security clearances at the very highest level, it puzzles me as to what would be withheld on the basis of national security concerns, unquote, Benveniste said. Well, I would submit that in all probability what is being withheld is information that we're going to touch on during this broadcast. In fact, we're going to present, namely, indications that even though the Clinton administration had one hand behind its back in the efforts to corral Osama bin Laden, due primarily to the profound Saudi economic influence in this country, both through investment and through the Saudi control of the oil industry, the fact of the matter is that even though the Clinton administration's efforts against al-Qaeda were attenuated, the Bush administration flat out gave the order to stay hands off the Saudis. We're going to talk about that later in the program. Of course, there's been a lot of discussion about what the Bush administration might have known. Would it have been possible to have anticipated what was going to happen? There were a lot of forewarnings that, in fact, the basic type of attack that was going to take place was going to take place. There were warnings from foreign intelligence services, including Egyptian and Italian, as well as Israeli intelligence services. American intelligence services as well were basically on the hunt. However, their warnings were not heeded. An article in the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, April 1st of 2004, summed up some of the forewarnings of the use of airliners as kamikazes. This article is by Scott Paltrow, Dateline Washington, and it's headlined, "Kamikaze Terrorism Wasn't New Idea." White House statements aside, protective state steps date back through Clinton administration. And I suspect that's one of the reasons why the Bush administration doesn't want to release this information. I'm not going to read the whole article. It's long, and we've covered this subject before. But there is a sidebar to the article that sums up the information. It's called Warning Signs. A look at some intelligence reports in the 1990s that warned of terrorist attacks with airliners. 1994 Eiffel Tower threat, quote, "Algerian armed Islamic group terrorists hijacked an Air France flight and threatened to crash it into the Eiffel Tower," unquote. 1995, Bojinka plot to blow up American jets, quote, "An accomplice of Ramzi Youssef told police in the Philippines and the FBI that a variant of the plot involved flying a plane on a suicide mission into CIA headquarters," unquote. 1996, Iranian plot to crash Japanese jet in Israel, quote, "A passenger would board the plane in the Far East, commandeer the aircraft, order it to fly low over Tel Aviv, and crash the plane into the city," unquote. 1998, alleged plan by Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists to crash plane into World Trade Center, quote, "A group since linked to Al-Qaeda planned to fly an explosive-laden plane from a foreign country into the World Trade Center," unquote. Alleged Osama bin Laden plot to crash plane into a U.S. airport, quote, "Bin Laden's next operation might involve flying an explosive-laden aircraft into a U.S. airport," unquote. 1999, Federal Research Division report on terrorism, quote, "Suicide bombers could crash land an aircraft into the Pentagon or the White House," unquote. All of those from the Clinton era, including specifically a 1998 plan to fly an explosive-laden plane from a foreign country into the World Trade Center. Despite that, obviously this administration was, to be as kinder than one should be, asleep at the wheel. Now, as we move into what happened during the Bush administration, early on in the Bush administration, the late John O'Neill, in charge of the FBI's investigation into Osama bin Laden, was deeply frustrated, perhaps most notably in his attempts at researching the Al-Qaeda presence in Yemen in connection with the bombing of the destroyer USS Cole that killed 17 U.S. sailors. The following is from the book Forbidden Truth, U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden. This book is co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquier, published in soft cover by Nation Books. We've used this book in the past. Of O'Neill and the State Department frustration of his investigation into the Cole bombing, John O'Neill was a rebel in a world where the president and his administration called the shots. In charge of investigating acts of terrorism by the Al-Qaeda organization, he went to Yemen in October of 2000 after the attack on the USS Cole in which 17 U.S. servicemen died. He lambasted the obstructionist attitude among American diplomats there. In the course of the investigation, it became clear that diplomats from the State Department and FBI investigators didn't share the same approach. The diplomats wanted to comply with the Yemenite regime in order to calm political relations, while the FBI wanted to solve the crime and find those responsible for the attack as quickly as possible. It was apparent that these two visions, these two cultures, could not coexist. After another dispute over the FBI agents' carrying of arms and the turning over of second-level suspects to the American authorities, the American ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, forbade John O'Neill and his team of, quote, Rambos, unquote, as the Yemenite authorities called them, from entering Yemen. This despite the fact that, according to O'Neill, the FBI had in hand all of the evidence needed to implicate Osama bin Laden's terrorist network in the attack. P.S. Two of the September 11th hijackers had also been implicated in the Cole attack as well. Sitting in the China Club at the top of a building overlooking Manhattan, John O'Neill recounted the heated exchange with the American ambassador, his disappointment in the State Department's impotence, feigned or not, and above all the threat of Osama bin Laden. For him, everything originated in Saudi Arabia, and everything could be explained and solved through that prism. Quote, "All of the answers, all of the clues allowing us to dismantle Osama bin Laden's organization can be found in Saudi Arabia," he told me, emphasizing, again quoting, "the inability of American diplomacy to get anything out of King Fahd," unquote, concerning terrorist networks. The reason? There was only one, corporate oil interests. Could this simple explanation keep the United States from investigating one of the principal terrorist networks in the world? Yes, for the simple reason that the American administration had refrained from using the investigation as a means of putting pressure on its Saudi friends. Since George W. Bush's election, quote, "the FBI was even more politically engaged," O'Neill said, "and that could be felt even on his own investigations," unquote, regarding Osama bin Laden. "Saudi Arabia has much more pressure on us than we have toward the kingdom," he said, considering the United States' dependency on its oil, and thus the State Department's need to have a, quote, "secure and stable," unquote, Saudi Arabia. Parenthetically, I would add there's also a tremendous amount of reinvested Saudi petrodollars in the U.S. economy, epitomized perhaps by the Carlyle Group and the now-defunct Arbusto Energy, two of the business ventures that linked the Bush and the bin Laden family in commerce. Continuing. During investigations into the attack on a military installation in Dahran on June 25, 1996, which killed 19 American soldiers, O'Neill went to Saudi Arabia himself to convince King Fahd to get the Saudi authorities to cooperate. But that was a lost cause because Saudi officials interrogated the principal suspects themselves, while the FBI was relegated to collecting material evidence from the bomb site. As for the relations between Al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia, the conclusions of my report, which was commissioned by the French intelligence service, did not surprise O'Neill, and he confirmed that bin Laden had close ties with, quote, "high-ranking personalities and families of the Saudi kingdom," unquote, in July 2001, contrary to their public statements. He believed, however, that the chances of getting the Saudis to cooperate were slim, and he called into question the FBI's extremely political, unquote, stance in this area, as well as that at the interior level. Of course, John O'Neill was on his first day as security director for the World Trade Center. Having resigned the FBI, he died in the September 11th attacks. Well, one of the reasons why the Bush administration was even more politically repressive of investigations into the Saudis, of course, was the fact that this administration is an oil administration. Both the president and the vice president are former petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas. The father of the seated president, also a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas, is the man for whom CIA headquarters is named. What we're going to do now is to review information from all of this is review from previous broadcasts, but we're going to review some information presented by BBC journalist Greg Palast concerning formal orders given by the Bush administration that basically put the whammy on the already compromised efforts at investigating bin Laden. It should be noted that even though the Clinton administration's efforts could have been more vigorous, they were exponentially more vigorous than those of the Bush administration. This is from Greg Palast's website at www.gregpalast.com. Full address will be in the description for the show. This is an article by Mr. Palast called "See No Evil, What Bush Didn't Want to Know About 9/11. Skipping down. "What we did discover was serious enough. To begin with, from less than happy FBI agents, we obtained an interesting document some 30 pages long marked secret. I've reproduced a couple of pages here, figure 2.1. Note the designation 1991. That's FBI speak for national security matter. According to insiders, FBI agents had wanted to check into two members of the bin Laden family, Abdullah and Omar, but were told to stay away by superiors until September 13, 2001. By then, Abdullah and Omar were long gone from the United States. By the way, remember that. We're going to come back into that because both Abdullah and Omar, both implicated in al-Qaeda-related terrorist activity, were flown out of the United States by the Bush administration in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. These members of the bin Laden family and other members of the Saudi elite were the only civilians who could fly in the United States after September 11th. Continuing, why no investigation of the brothers bin Laden? The Bush administration's line is the bin Ladens, a more common spelling of the Arabic name, are good folk. Osama's the black sheep, supposedly cut off from his Saudi kin. But the official line notwithstanding, some FBI agents believed the family had some gray sheep worth questioning, especially those two working with the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, or WAMY, which the file labels a suspected terrorist organization, unquote. By the way, remember WAMY? Not only is it connected to Al-Qaeda, but later on in the broadcast, we're going to take a look at individuals who are connected with the WAMY, who are also connected with the Islamic Institute and the Republican Party. So remember that. More about the WAMY, turning back to the Greg Palast article. No matter how vile WAMY's indoctrination chats, they are none of the FBI's business. Recruitment for terror, however, is. Before 9/11, the governments of India and the Philippines tied WAMY to groups staging murderous attacks on civilians. Following our broadcast on BBC, the Dutch Secret Service stated that WAMY, quote, supported violent activity, unquote. In 2002, the Wall Street Journal's Glenn Simpson made public a report by Bosnia's government that a charity with Abdullah bin Laden on its board had channeled money to Chechen guerrillas. Two of the 9/11 hijackers used an address on the same street as WAMY's office in Falls Church, Virginia. Despite these tantalizing facts, Abdullah and his operations were A-OK with the FBI chiefs, if not their working agents. Just a dumb snafu? Not according to a top-level CIA operative who spoke with us on condition of strictest anonymity. After Bush took office, he said, there was a major policy shift, unquote, at the National Security Agency. Investigators were ordered to back off, unquote, from any inquiries into Saudi Arabian financing of terror networks, especially if they touched on Saudi royals and their retainers. That put the bin Ladens, a family worth a reported $12 billion and a virtual arm of the Saudi royal household, off limits for investigation. Osama was the exception. He remained a wanted man, but agents couldn't look too closely at how he filled his piggy bank. The key rule of any investigation, follow the money, was now violated, and investigations, at least before 9/11, began to die. And there was a lot to investigate, or in the case of the CIA and FBI under Bush, a lot to ignore. Through well-known international arms dealers, I'm sorry, but in this business, sinners are better sources than saints, our team was tipped off to a meeting of Saudi billionaires at the Hotel Royal Monceau in Paris in May of 1996 with the financial representative of Osama bin Laden's network. The Saudis, including a key Saudi prince joined by Muslim and non-Muslim gun traffickers, met to determine who would pay how much to Osama. This was not so much an act of support but of protection, a payoff to keep the mad bomber away from Saudi Arabia. And still more from Greg Palast on this same subject. This is an article talking about how among the elements that were basically put off limits to American intelligence investigators is the Saudi financing that lay behind a nuclear smuggling ring featuring Dr. Khan of Pakistan, and that was apparently involved in channeling critical nuclear technology to, among others, North Korea, Libya, and Iran. Once again from Greg Palast's website, Con Job, Bush-spiked probe of Pakistan's Dr. Strangelove, BBC reported in 2001, we read, on November 7, 2001, BBC TV and The Guardian of London reported that the Bush administration thwarted investigations of Dr. A.Q. Khan, who this week confessed to selling atomic secrets to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. The Bush administration has expressed shock at the disclosures that Pakistan, our ally in the war on terror, has been running a nuclear secrets bazaar. In fact, according to the British news team sources, Bush did not know of these facts because shortly after his inauguration, his National Security Agency effectively stymied the probe of Khan Research Laboratories. CIA and other agents could not investigate the spread of Islamic bombs through Pakistan because funding appeared to originate in Saudi Arabia. We talked about that in, among other programs, FDR's 447 and 450. Now, I mentioned that among the major factors for the Bush administration's hands-off attitude towards the Saudi funding of terrorism was not only the fact that Saudi Arabia has so much oil under its control and the fact that there's a tremendous reinvestment of Saudi petrodollars in the American economy, including business ventures that joined the Bush family and the bin Laden family, but also the Bush administration through Vice President Dick Cheney, again, like George Bush himself, a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas, the Bush administration was attempting to get Enron, the soon-to-be-declared bankrupt Enron, off the hook by having Enron as the official broker for the UNICAL consortium attempting to swing a pipeline through Afghanistan. In this, Enron was basically functioning as a proxy for UNICAL, and they were dealing with the Taliban and the Saudi underwriters of Al-Qaeda, and the very wealthy bin Laden family construction firm was apparently promised some of the action on the proposed Afghan pipeline. Now, in a paper that we're about to excerpt that we've already looked at in FTR 362, this from the heroic government investigator John Loftus, it is revealed that not only was Dick Cheney and Enron working on behalf of UNICAL to secure the Afghan pipeline, but that this was known to Al-Qaeda's operations chief, Mohammed Atef, and appears to have been a major factor in permitting Al-Qaeda to go ahead with September 11th. From John Loftus's website, www.john-loftus.com, the following is entitled The Enron Pipeline Connection to 9/11. A highly respectable confidential client source who wishes to remain anonymous has promised to send me an FBI copy of a high-level Al-Qaeda report dating back to the embassy bombings in Africa several years ago. The email report was captured in Africa from the computer file of a senior aide to Osama bin Laden. My client has obtained this document through lawful means. The email report, written by Al-Qaeda's head of military operations, Mohammed Atef, describes Al-Qaeda's view of ongoing secret pipeline negotiations between the U.S. oil companies and the Taliban to build a pipeline through Afghanistan. This Atef report was almost certainly reviewed by the late John O'Neill at the time of the embassy bombing, shortly after the Al-Qaeda report was written. At the time, O'Neill was the FBI agent in charge of the embassy bombing investigation. The shocking pipeline information may explain why O'Neill became fixated about the Saudi-Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship for the remaining years of his life. After O'Neill's investigations were repeatedly shut down by his superiors, O'Neill allegedly began making discreet inquiries to French intelligence using two reporters as cutouts. Both reporters were known consultants for French intelligence and are specialists on both the oil industry and terrorism. It's plausible that the French government was upset at being shut out of the Caspian Basin deal and may have been helping O'Neill behind the backs of his superiors in Washington. It does seem that the more O'Neill learned, the less he was allowed to do with it. The last straw was Cheney's refusal to follow up on O'Neill's request to pursue the leads in the Phoenix memo in April of 2001. After resigning from the FBI in disgust, John O'Neill spoke candidly to several people, including the two French authors whom he met again in July. They have now written about the pipeline deal in The Forbidden Truth. The book, not yet translated into English, quotes O'Neill as saying that his Al-Qaeda investigations were blocked to protect the Saudis. The Caspian Basin pipeline issue is discussed at length as the motive for the cover-up. I do not think that the French authors have the Atef document or they would have released it in their book. The Atef memo may indeed be a smoking gun, but I need to see the exact text to be sure before I release it to Congress. This Al-Qaeda document may be the first hard evidence to break the Enron pipeline cover-up apart. I need your advice and confidential assistance in making a discreet collection of all Afghan pipeline research for a memo to present to Congress. Here is my investigative hypothesis, which needs to be greatly fleshed out and footnoted before I go to Congress. I have presented my thoughts on the topic rather than in chronological order. Back in the 70s and 80s, Saudi intelligence, not the CIA as has been reported, funded the early Taliban faction and later Al-Qaeda as part of the insurgency to throw the Russians out of Afghanistan. A few years afterwards, U.S. energy companies, Enron as the Afghan pipeline consultant for UNICAL, used the Saudi intelligence connection to the Taliban to begin negotiations for a pipeline across Afghanistan. Prince Turki, chief of Saudi intelligence, has publicly admitted making several trips into Afghanistan to negotiate a peace mission with the Taliban. My sources say he was the pipeline mediator for Enron. Prince Turki was fired as head of Saudi intelligence immediately after the pipeline discussions collapsed in August of 2001. Prince Turki is allegedly close to the bin Laden family, which was allegedly promised the construction contract in return for a percentage to the Saudi royal family. This is a common business practice initiated by the Carlyle Group's contracts in Saudi Arabia. Skipping down. But if the Taliban pipeline had been built, Enron might have owned some of the most valuable oil exploration sites in the world and rescued itself from insolvency. Any White House insider who helped Enron would have gotten rich. Filthy rich. When Bush's son came into office, Enron allegedly approached Cheney in late January and told him vaguely about the secret Saudi-Taliban pipeline negotiations and how important it was to America's energy policy for generations to come. Like an idiot, Cheney agreed to keep the lid on any Saudi-Taliban investigations for a while. For the sake of the Caspian Basin pipeline, Cheney passed the word inside the Beltway not to allow anyone in the government to connect the dots. All across America, ongoing Saudi-Taliban investigations were hindered, obstructed, or closed down, just as the Clinton administration had done before them. What no one did was check Enron's accounting. The pipeline deal made little economic sense in view of Russian cooperation. To Enron's horror, the pipeline deal collapsed in August. Then came 9/11, then came the Enron collapse, then came the Cheney cover-up. Cheney's biggest problem is the fairly two senior intelligence officials who rebelled and became whistleblowers, Robert Baer of the CIA and the late John O'Neill of the FBI. The rest of the FBI and CIA higher-ups have kept their mouths shut, although a lot of lower-level people now are coming forward to question their superiors' strange behavior. The two rebels, Baer of CIA and O'Neill of FBI, were, of course, driven into retirement. Skipping down. Cheney was not the first to block the investigations, but he is probably the last to be involved with the cover-up. That could explain why he is resisting Congress on both the Enron and pre-9/11 intelligence documents. If Congress ever connects the two investigations, the whole house of cards will collapse. Most of my sources say that Bush and Rice may have been deliberately kept out of the loop by Cheney. For example, it was Cheney, not Rice, who saw the Phoenix memo before 9/11. By the way, that's one of the memos that forecasts the use of airplanes as kamikaze weapons. Continuing, it is, however, theoretically possible that the president may have known about the pipeline deal from his own sources. President Bush's father was the leading lobbyist for the Saudis and may have been told everything by his Carlyle Group partners, the Bin Laden family, who were supposedly in line to get the Taliban pipeline construction contract. But it's doubtful we'll ever know what Bush Sr. told his son while the pipeline negotiations were underway. In terms of the upcoming congressional investigation, the Al-Qaeda document is the first direct written evidence to confirm the existence of secret pipeline negotiations with the Taliban. Moreover, it confirms that Al-Qaeda was informed of these negotiations from the earliest stages. This raises an interesting question. The Al-Qaeda author, Mohammed Attaf, must have known that his report had fallen into American hands when his operative's computer was captured by the FBI. Attaf may have been surprised that his pipeline report was never made public to embarrass the Taliban. Attaf may have suspected, merely from the surprising silence, that the CIA and FBI were not being allowed to pursue or reveal their Afghanistan investigations while the pipeline negotiations were still underway. The Saudis could certainly have tipped off the Taliban and that the fix was in. It is hard to believe that the Bin Laden Construction Company did not learn anything from their Carlyle Group partners about the pipeline. Whatever the source, the early date of the Attaf report shows that the highest levels of Al-Qaeda certainly knew about the pipeline secret from the beginning. The pipeline cover-up could have convinced Attaf that Al-Qaeda could exploit the lack of coordinated intelligence against them. In addition to the usual interagency bungling, the Enron cover-up was the real reason for the black hole in U.S. intelligence about events in Afghanistan, and plausibly explains why no U.S. agency was allowed to collect the dots. Moreover, it explains why honest officials like Baer and O'Neill were driven into retirement. Bottom line, Baer and O'Neill were right. There was a pipeline cover-up, and it very likely contributed to 9/11. The Attaf report raises the founded suspicion based on specific, articulable facts that Al-Qaeda might have piggybacked on the Enron secrecy blackout to launch their surprise attack, confident in their knowledge that U.S. intelligence had been deliberately blinded by Enron's cronies in Washington. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 454, The War President in Action, being recorded on April 4th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.